Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Richard Rossi Live, and I am so excited about today's interview. Frank Schaefer has had an incredible impact on my life. My wife Sherry and I met at Cherry Falls Liberty University back in the 80s. We got married there in 84. It'll be 30 years this year that we've been married. But for those of you not familiar with Jerry Falwell and the religious right, it was a very totalitarian environment. We weren't allowed to go to movies. We weren't, you know, that was a sin. We had a book called The Liberty Way. It was anything but liberty. We couldn't go to movies. We couldn't, you know, listen to secular music. The whole mindset was, you know, very controlling and something that we've had to recover from in many ways. But Frank Schaefer and his father Francis Schaefer were just our, you know, idols are in this world. They were writing some of the most brilliant evangelical books and came to our campus and spoke and kind of shook things up. And then Frank has gone on to make his own journey from fundamentalism to freedom and is now a best-selling author, incredible multimedia artist, really a renaissance man. He's a painter. He's a writer. He does so many things, a filmmaker. So we'll be back in about 20 seconds live with Frank. So don't go anywhere, and thank you so much for tuning in. If you're from a Christian background or not, you'll find this fascinating. Welcome back to Richard Rossi Live, and I'm live with Frank Schaefer. Welcome to the show, Frank. I am elated that you are here today.
Hey, it's my pleasure, Richard. We go way back.
Yeah, we sure do. When you first came to Liberty University, which for those who don't know that, Jerry Falwell was the chancellor there, and when you guys came in, it really kind of rocked the world, speaking from a student standpoint, because as I said in the intro, we weren't even allowed to attend movies or engage with secular culture. It was we had to sign a thing that said we had to be separatists, in other words, disengage from the secular culture. And
right.
And even though you and your dad were, you know, such a big part of starting that whole religious right thing, there still was a difference in that, you know, it was controversial when you came and you talked about, you know, you and your dad had an appreciation for arts and the culture. And so it seemed like there was a duality that you were kind of in bed with the religious right, yet, you know, even back then somewhat questioning some of it. I mean, what's your, you know, your memory of that time?
Well, just that, you know, if you kind of go back, I'm 62 now and father of three, grandfather of four, another little one on the way in April. But if I roll the clock back into my early 20s, I had become the kind of nepotistic sidekick of my father on the big-time evangelical circuit. And, of course, a lot has happened since then. But and I've gotten out of the movement long since and written a lot of different books, fiction and nonfiction and so forth. But one of the things that I was interested in then, as I am today, is the relationship of art and culture. And that really hasn't changed much. So, you know, my father took a stand on the issue of abortion after Roe v. Wade. But when it came to things like art, for instance, he had written this book called How Should We Then Live that was fully illustrated, and we made a film series to go with it. And I remember back then Jerry Falwell and other people objecting to the book and saying, you know, we're going to have trouble using this in our classrooms because you've got a nude Michelangelo's David with his genitals fully exposed. You know, why couldn't you photograph it differently? You know, there's a Madonna here with their breast out from a you know, a 14th century Italian artwork. Why did you do this? I mean, how can this work in the Christian market? And, of course, what they meant by the Christian market was not the classical commitment of many Christians to art and culture through the centuries. They're talking about the fundamentalist American evangelical experience of Christianity, which is one of the narrower, I guess, parts of the Christian experience. But, you know, Dad really wasn't coming from that angle. In a way, you know, history has been unfair to him, and I've tried to set some of that right in some of my books, you know, a memoir like Crazy for God, for instance, where I talk about his commitment to art and culture, opening his home to people who came, you know, back in the hippie and beat generation days, meeting with people like Timothy Leary, who was this, you know, drug guru, and others. Dad was not an evangelical religious right figure before he got into the politics of the 1970s over the abortion issue. So, you know, I'm kind of torn because it's a world I left, and it's a world that in some ways I really dislike intensely. But when I look back on what my parents actually did in their own ministry, their acceptance of gay people, for instance, that were never persecuted or thrown out of their ministry called LaBrie Fellowship, and Dad's commitment to the arts, he's a very complex figure, whereas a guy like Jerry Falwell is very one-dimensional. He's almost a cartoon. I mean, you can predict everything he would say on any subject. And a kind of an anti-cultural bias, an anti-art bias, anti-film, anti-secular anything, a sense of threat from the academic community, so you've got to start your own college, you know, the homeschool movement to protect children from big bad ideas like evolution or sex education. You know, this was his world. Whereas my dad came into that in agreement with some issues, such as on abortion, disagreement on others. And even though my father had a very conservative, fundamentalist commitment to Scripture, for instance, to the Bible, yet the way he treated people and his own interests was much, much wider than anything that someone like Falwell represented. And so, you know, in my own writing since, I've tried to unpick some of this, both in my fiction and nonfiction, and, you know, try to not throw the baby out with the bathwater when it came to my parents' legacy. And, of course, now I'm in a very different place in my own life, and most of my readers, you know, who say buy a book because they see me on Rachel Maddow being interviewed by Rachel or Al Sharpton's show, or they hear me being interviewed on Fresh Air by Terry Gross, you know, they've never heard of Frances Schaeffer. They've only heard of me as a writer of fiction and nonfiction who then mines this interesting past, you know, just like someone maybe who was raised in a steel mill town in the 50s and 60s would now be writing novels and nonfiction about the experience of growing up in a steel mill, a town dominated by the steel industry. Well, similarly, you know, I mine my evangelical past for my literary nonfiction and my fiction. But to people who were raised in the evangelical world, especially of my generation, the name Frances Schaeffer and Edith Schaeffer were really big names. So there's a kind of a curiosity factor that goes with some of my writing, a kind of a second tier of readers who come to my writing knowing a lot. And you'd be one of those people. You're someone who goes so far back into my own past, and we've had similar journeys out of that environment that, you know, when you read something of mine, you're kind of reading between the lines and seeing a whole second narrative there, I would guess. Would that be correct?
Yeah, like your new book, In God Said Billy, it really resonates. And for those of you listening, In God Said Billy is on Amazon, and, you know, you can learn more about all Frank's stuff at frankschaeffer.com, as well as his painting at frankschaeffert.com, I think it is. But In God Said Billy, your newest novel, I was really grabbed by this central character who believes, you know, his every thought is God talking to him. And, you know, my wife and I have spent a significant time in the charismatic movement. And
right.
I come from a family where we've had mental health issues in our family. And
yeah.
I've noticed that can... you know, people that begin to think every thought in their head is God talking to justify their, you know, crazy behavior. I have a very dear friend who, a minister that was had a bipolar diagnosis recently, and he went off the deep end with a lot of his impulses, thinking it was the Holy Spirit talking to him.
Right.
And what a character. I know a novel is an internal, interior kind of writing form, but even
right.
more so, I was just in such awe of how you captured his voices in his head. And you had to know that world to write it. I think, like you said, you've really drawn from that world to write this
right.
novel, huh?
Well, And God Said Billy is really set in three environments that I personally experienced on a very deep level. The first, of course, is this evangelical background where Billy thinks he hears the voice of God. And, of course, as you know, coming from that background, a secular reader would find that far-fetched and would say, you know, why wasn't he locked up? But there are millions of charismatic Christians walking around today, right now, who aren't being locked up, who are probably successful business people or, you know, running car dealerships. But when they all get together, the lingo they speak, God told me this, God told me that, I heard God speak to me, I woke up last night and I felt God touching my life and speaking to me. Billy just goes one step further, and that is, you know, the title, And God Said Billy, the word Billy is in quotation marks and with an exclamation point, because he's actually hearing God say Billy. He really believes that. And then he feels that God has called him out to Hollywood, this is in the mid-1980s, to save Hollywood for Jesus, or as he puts it, from all those secular Jews and homosexuals, and get it back into, you know, Christian America. And of course, I was in Hollywood in the 80s making four low-budget feature films, which, you know, I probably wouldn't have paid to go see, but it was a living after I'd gotten out of the evangelical background. So I experienced the low-budget Hollywood world. And a couple of those movies actually we shot in Africa, which brings me to the latter part of the book, where Billy goes off to South Africa and makes a movie, or tries to make a movie, low-budget film, busting the sanctions era when people weren't supposed to be making movies or singing at Sun City or all these other things when the sanctions were in place, and it was the fashionable thing in Hollywood not to go to South Africa to do anything in order to stand against apartheid. Well, he's given this opportunity to make a first feature. He goes out to South Africa. So then the second part of the story is actually set in the apartheid era of South Africa, which then brings it full circle, because, not to give everything away, but when he gets in trouble there and the police are after him, the policeman who's after him is a Calvinist Christian who, you know, in turn believes South Africa is the chosen people and that whites are supposed to be in charge. And so really, the novel, you know, And God Said Billy is a way for me to look at my own life, because I was in the movie business, I was in the crazy end of the evangelical business for a while, I was in the crazy end of the movie business for a while, and I lived in South Africa and Namibia for a year, where the book takes place in the second part. And really, the experience of being in South Africa in the apartheid era, having been raised as a Calvinist evangelical, was like seeing ghosts, because, of course, the language of the white minority that was oppressing the black majority was all cast in the lingo of biblical, evangelical, and especially Calvinist views of predestination. They regarded themselves as the new Israel, just as the Bay State Colony here in Massachusetts, where I live with people like Winthrop, regarded themselves as the new Israel. And of course, in every instance, what it gives you permission to do is treat the people who you are killing or enslaving as the same sort of captives that the Bible says it was fine for the Israelites to enslave, captive, kill, commit genocide against when they were after the Canaanites or the men, whatever it may be, the Moabites and so on. And so really, And God Said Billy is a work of humor, and, you know, you were telling me you found it very funny and so on. But deep inside that novel, beside being a kind of semi-biographical portrait of my own journey, carried to another level, is a story about the terrible effect that Christianity has had on the globe, and when it is used by people like the apartheid regime in South Africa to justify their racism, when it is used by evangelicals here in this country to get into a culture war. You know, they send crazy people like Billy out to South Africa or Hollywood, wherever it is, thinking they're called by God, really doing far more harm than good. So for me, it was writing And God Said Billy. Actually, I worked on it a long time and did several other projects in the interim, books like my memoir, Crazy for God, and other projects. But I kept coming back to it because, you know, it tells my story, but it also, I think if someone reads And God Said Billy, they're going to understand our country better than they did before, whether they know anything about evangelicals or not, because in his craziness and in his journey, you know, is really a portrait of the kind of lunacy that is unhooked a lot of American life, whether it's foreign policy or culture wars, gay bashing, whatever. And then just, you know, by the end of the book, he's found a very different kind of spirituality. I won't talk about it more than that, except to say that for someone who approaches the book who personally has some sort of Christian faith, I think by the time they get to the end, they're going to see that I am not knocking the idea of faith. This is not a new atheist contribution like Dawkins or someone would make, but I'm looking hard at the kind of unhinged American experience of Christian faith that's done so much damage, and then holding up, I hope, what is a very positive alternative in a surprising way toward the end of the book. So that's probably more than you wanted to know, but there you go.
Well, I find such a comfort in your honesty about the uncertainty, because we both came from a world where it was all about certainty, and when we were at the Liberty University School, we could spit out a Bible verse, you know, like a theological jukebox for everything. And
right.
When I read your writings, be it the fiction and, you know, Patience with God, Crazy for God, I see your journey. It seems like you've been willing to really embrace the mystery. You know, I think Romans talks about the unsearchable mystery of God.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I like how you also, you take on both the Dawkins, the militant atheists that are trafficking in certainty, and the Falwellian fundamentalists that are trafficking in certainty, and say, you know, really both of those extremes are kind of toxic.
Yeah, I mean, the point is, you know, that I've made in books like Patience with God, and in a way, actually, it's the point of And God Said Billy, because he winds up in that same kind of area where he begins to see that you either embrace mystery and or you go crazy, because life is a paradox, if nothing else. You know, my critique of, say, the New Atheist movement doesn't come from a place of trying to convert anybody, because I don't believe anyone's lost. I mean, it's a different view. But I must say, I think a lot of us have become a little unhinged on the secular side as well as on the religious side, because we are very much primitive creatures at the beginning of our evolutionary trajectory. I mean, after all, the human brain did not evolve to do philosophy, cosmology, and science. The human brain evolved to survive. And we process the information we get. You know, right now I'm looking out a window here in Massachusetts at snow on my lawn. Of course, my brain is actually processing 90% of the information, where the visual information is only 10%. And the same goes with everything else. You know, our brains look for patterns and try to give us a structure so that we can survive. They weren't built for philosophy and cosmology. And we kind of made the jump into those fields, but I guess what I'm saying is a little humility is in order when it comes to making vast cosmological statements, be they the one I'm making right now, just to be ironic about it, or if it's Richard Dawkins, or if it is a Jerry Falwell, and back off for a minute and just say, hey, listen, you know, give it a few thousand more years of evolution if we survive ourselves, and we'll see, you know, we'll see at that point what we make of the cosmos and our origins and all these other things. Meanwhile, let's try to find a way to actually experience the beauty and the connection that we have with the world around us and other people, and put less emphasis on waving banners claiming to have the truth, capital letters. And so I'd say I'm just kind of, after my fundamentalist background and leaving it, I'm sort of allergic to massive truth claims made on any level when they become exclusionary and essentially paint whoever you're disagreeing with as a complete idiot. So, you know, my place is a little awkward in that, you know, I'm someone who will write a book like And God Said Billy, but not exactly hue to, say, the perfect new atheist vision that then brings you an automatic readership because, you know, Dawkins presses all the buttons. Or on the other hand, you know, I'm also banned, of course, from all religious bookstores because my views are regarded as sacrilegious these days by evangelicals. So I don't quite fit. And I guess for me, that's not deliberate. It's not trying to carve out any kind of a special place. It's just that's the way the cookie crumbles in my case, given my weird background and my journey. You know, when we were off the air before the show, you were saying, well, should you mention this book I've been working on that'll be coming out in May? And the title's instructive there, and so I will bring it up, even though it's pointless right now because it's not for sale. But just to make a point, the title of the book is really kind of an answer to all these emails I've been getting off the other books. And so I've called it Why I Am an Atheist Who Believes in God, which of course is a contradiction, and that's the point. Mm-hmm. Because from my point of view, unless you're willing to embrace contradictory reality, i.e. paradox, you're not really looking at things as they are, which is that we don't really have full understanding of these things. And so to me, it's not a contradiction to say that I'm an atheist that believes in God, because it depends what day you catch me on. And I guess one of the points I'm making in that book is that I've never actually met an atheist or a believer. I've only met people who are of one, two, three, or four minds, just like I've never met anybody who's entirely in love with their wife, no matter how long they've been married, who never looks at another woman. I've never met anybody who's entirely patriotic. I've never met a gay person who's entirely gay. I've never met a heterosexual who's entirely heterosexual. We live in a complicated world. So I am not one. I am becoming increasingly leery of labels, and I think we wear these labels so we can fit with a group. You know, you want to identify yourself as an atheist so you know who you are, who your friends are supposed to be. You identify yourself as a Calvinist evangelical so you can go to a church and feel comfortable. Truth of the matter is, in the quiet of the night, it's like parenthood. You know, I'm a father and I'm a grandfather, and I'm a grown-up to these little kids. What they don't know is when, you know, I'm 62, I lie awake at night realizing I'm still the same old schmuck I always was. They think I know something. I know I don't. and we all kind of wear these labels and these uniforms, but in the dead of night, you know, if you're honest, you know yourself, you know you're of several minds, you know you don't really know what you're doing, that life's too short to learn much, and that's the truth as far as I see it. So I've tried to work out that theme in And God Said Billy by having him run into a monastic character at the end in a Russian Orthodox monastery being run by a 70-year-old black African monk from Ethiopia, and who really presents him with this idea of paradoxical uncertainty as opposed to his fundamentalist certainty. So I don't think the choice is between, you know, Richard Dawkins and Jerry Falwell. I don't see the world in black and white like that, or, you know, that's the way I would put it, and I guess that's the point of the book.
Mm. Yeah, I love the honesty that, you know, is in your writings. Because, I mean, even in the biblical characters, you know, John the Baptist, after saying, "Behold the Lamb of God," when he's in prison and discouraged, he said, "Is he
right.
the one?" So, I mean, even these Bible characters go through these doubts, and yet, you know, the fundamentalists just kind of sell this this certainty that's really not honest. In fact, I remember one of your books, I think it might have been Crazy for God, where you even talk about the ultimate evangelical, Billy Graham, who...
Right.
You know, just so gifted at preaching to those, you know, big stadiums and everything, calling your father and, you know, struggling with his own doubts about death or salvation, if I remember.
Right. Yeah, absolutely right. Dad and Billy were friends, and in fact, they would know each other quite well over many, many, many years, but then got together rather poignantly when my dad was dying of cancer in Mayo Clinic, and Billy would visit him because Billy was in there for a number of health issues at a similar time, and they overlapped. And Dad always came out of those meetings saying, you know, in privacy, Billy was someone who was very uncertain, afraid of death, didn't know whether anything he had been preaching was true or not, made public proclamations. But I said to Dad, "Well, do you think he's a hypocrite?" He said, "No, he's just like everybody else. He just can't say this publicly because they've got a multi-million-dollar, in fact, multi-billion-dollar organization built on his certainty."
Mm-hmm.
But my father, you know, would say, "Well, you know, he's just in the same boat everybody's in." But I think it's too bad that so many religious figures, or for that matter, new atheist leaders, if you want to go to the other extreme, don't have are so aware that they're either selling books or leading a movement or gurus or are looked up to or have, as they would view it, a responsibility to their readers that they don't tell you the truth. So, you know, I'm a writer and I've written, you know, whatever it is, more than a dozen books and some bestsellers and so forth. And I can tell you, if I've learned one thing from my experience, it's that A, you change your mind. B, 10 years later, you would never write the book the same way. C, mm-hmm. my reader, say you, who reads And God Said Billy right now and are enjoying it, if you come back 10 years from now to that same book, it will be a different book to you, not because anything mm-hmm. changed inside the book, but you did. So much for changeless truth. It's all perception. And I think that no matter where we fall on a spectrum of ideology politically or where we fall on a spectrum of ideology religiously or no religion at all, it behooves us to adopt enough honesty and humility in discussion with other people to understand that no matter how vocally we are arguing a point right now, this second, right now as we talk on the radio, both of us could have changed our minds radically 10 years from now and would be mm-hmm. denouncing our own point of view. How do I know that? Because I did it. When I go back and hear snatches of stuff I said, for instance, as the keynote speaker at the Southern Baptist Convention, however many 20-plus years ago it was, more than that, you know, whatever it was, 30 years ago now, you know, I cringe. Who is this idiot? I would say if you could give me a recording of this conversation 20 years from now, I might feel the same about it in exactly the same way as you look at a 1950s movie and a lot of the performances seem overwrought and unnatural and weird, and we think, oh, well, you know, acting is much better now, we're more natural and so forth. Believe me, 30 years from now, the peculiarities of what we take to be good dramatic performances will look just as dated as 1940s and 50s movies look overwrought, stagey, spoken too loud because they were all used to stage performance. They were making their transition into film. We can see all those points. A few years from now, we'll be looking at ourselves in our own era the same way, or at least our children and grandchildren will. So I think that's the way things really are. And in God Said Billy, I try to actually paint that kind of evolutionary picture of character development rather than freeze this guy in time. You know, I let him go somewhere, and I let him change his mind. I let Billy change his mind. So he's crazy, but he has the ability to change his mind, and I just think that's the hope we all have.
Yeah, I'm just so thankful for the grace to, you know, change our mind. And it's weird now because, you know, I have a lot of friends that I went to school with, and it seems like they fall into those that keep kind of growing and stretching. But then I do have those friends that will are still diehard, you know, follow the Liberty Way folks and haven't seemed to change one iota. And I don't know if
right.
it's the security of that world. It is. There is a feeling of kind of a false safety, I guess, when you feel you have all the answers and have all the rules, huh?
Yeah, and, you know, we're not talking about individuals here, so I don't feel I'm being overly harsh. But let's be honest. You know, there's a good living in them, our God hills, in a lot mm-hmm. of these places. You know, the pastor of a church, the missionary, the teacher in a Bible school, just the evangelical figure in the community, wherever it may be. There's a lot of places where it does not pay to jump ship. You know, looking back on my own life, I never earned more money than I did in my early 20s, you know, when I was pulling down huge honorariums, and where my books, like A Time for Anger, which was an evangelical screed I wrote back in the day before I was really mm-hmm. a writer, I think, you know, that's sold by the pallet load. What individual copies of And God Said Billy say now, if I had stuck with the program, you know, I'd be very rich right now and very comfortable, and there wouldn't be much of aside from the fact my marriage would have collapsed and I'd hate everybody, other than that, and that I would be definitely be an atheist completely now, because there's no way to lose your faith faster than being a professional Christian, but I could keep up a good act for a long time, and I think there's a lot of evangelicals in leadership positions who, if they're my age and they're talking the way they did when they were 20, 25, either they have flipped out and something broke in their brains, or they are liars, and inside somewhere deeply they know they're lying. Because I'll tell you what, nobody remains, you know, that solid and fixed in their views. And so I think a lot of these folks, as they get older, do what you're talking about and just stick with the program for security's sake. But if you could get inside their head and really take a look around for 5 minutes, you'd find a very different person in there than the one that's presented to the public.
Yeah, and
I'm afraid that's the case.
Yeah, I'm sure we both have quite a few, you know, secrets in the sense of the people that have come confidentially to me, and I know
sure.
a lot more to you probably that have said, you know, Richard, I can trust you. You're kind of a merciful, non-judgmental
right.
guy. You know, big Christian leader, but, you know, secretly I'm gay, you know, or
right, exactly.
I think this stuff is all nonsense.
Right.
But, you know, I just got to tell someone, and I know since your books have come out, you've probably had just scores of emails of people saying, thank you, Frank, for,
yeah, and
you know,
it surprised me because I dropped out of the evangelical loop, you know, back in the late 1980s, early 1990s, and I was gone. I mean, I didn't have anything to do with these guys. They didn't call me. I didn't call them. I wasn't invited anywhere. And I was just gone, like my name had been taken off the map. So I then went off and wrote these quote-unquote secular novels, like Portofino and Zermatt and Saving Grandma, and even though they were set in that environment, because it's where I'd lived, I had secular readers. I wasn't hearing from quote-unquote Christians.
Mm-hmm.
And then I wrote a couple of books about my son being in the Marine Corps, Keeping Faith, a father-son story about love in the United States Marine Corps, that became a New York Times bestseller after Oprah interviewed me, which tends to do that to books.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, all of a sudden I'm down there, you know, doing talks on military-civilian relations that I have no qualifications for, but I've written a book, so they think I must know something. So then, you know, that world, I had nothing to do with evangelicals. And then I wrote this memoir, Crazy for God, and then talked to my wife and said, well, you know, I'm in my 50s, I'm going to write this memoir, what really happened back there, but I'm expecting, you know, a real storm, because I remembered these people as all very angry and defensive, like you do from Jerry Falwell's school. The reverse happened. Yeah, there was a few nasty things said. Yes, I got a few odd letters. Yes, there were a couple of nasty reviews in some of the big evangelical press. Then all of a sudden this trickle of mail and then emails began, because it was just cutting into the big email era. And to my astonishment, and I'm not making this up, the emails were running about 100 to 1, saying, well, first of all, from a lot of secular people who said, we never knew anything about this world, thank you for helping us discover it. But from the readers that had evangelical backgrounds saying, you know, we've been on a similar journey. You know, thanks for telling my story. We different details, same vibe. So I've had to be humbled myself in this regard, and that is that, I sort of shook the dust off my shoes and stomped out, but the evangelical world has changed in that mm-hmm. there's a whole other group of progressive Christians in there mm-hmm. and or people who have lost their faith but still kind of pine for some of those old certainties who are really perplexed. And that group of people are, not just friendly to my work, but have adopted it, beautifully and are always in touch with me and continue to encourage this writing I'm doing. And really, I kind of wrote And God Said Billy for those readers saying, okay, you want to hear the real story here. Here's the deal. This is how raw and crazy this got for me personally, although I set it in a fiction world. And here's what I think some of the solutions might be in terms of personal spirituality. It's not a choice, as I said, between Dawkins and Falwell. There are other options in terms of the mystery of faith.
Wow. Well, I tell you, I'm just amazed. Einstein said time is relative and feel,
right.
When you're doing something that's interesting, I feel like the 30 minutes has gone by like 3 minutes here. Those of you listening, these books are fantastic, both the fiction and nonfiction that Frank's wrote, and also his art. I'm so thrilled to see you. I remember you saying even back in the day that you got away from your painting when you were in fundamentalist world, so I'm so happy that you're getting back to it. So frankschaefer.com has a lot of Frank stuff, but also frankschaeferart.com, you can see his paintings.
That people have been buying them online. Crazy. It's
awesome. So you're shipping these all over the world.
Yes, I am. I put it up thinking, where's this going to go? And fortunately, call it ego stroking or whatever, but people apparently like my pictures. And, of course, they're going to Facebook and seeing them too, because if you like my Facebook page, then, they're all there. So I'm doing all the usual Twittering, Facebooking, and all that stuff. But frankschaeferart.com is where you can take a look at what I'm working on.
Wow. Well, I am so eternally grateful. When you have the book out in May, I'd love to have you back on about the new book.
Yeah, let's do it. Just it'll be all over my Facebook page, and just call and we'll do it again. And if you email me, Richard, and just ask for an advance thing, I'm just doing the copy editing now, and as soon as that's done, I'll send you the manuscript
wonderful.
As a file, and then you can, decide whether you still want to talk to me or not.
Oh, I'm sure I will, because I'm... When it comes to your books, Frank, I not only read them once, my Patience with God book has been read about 6 times with underlines in many places. So.
Well, I'm glad that I got one reader that likes my stuff. Thank you. That's lovely.
Well, you're most welcome. And everyone listening in, it's frankschaefer.com, frankschaeferart.com. And just real quick, I know Blog Talk Radio has given me a little grace here for an extra minute, but just our upcoming guests real quick. Friday, Kathy Garver, who played on the iconic show Family Affair, Surviving Sissy. She played that gorgeous teenage girl on that show. And then we have an Oscar winner on Saturday from the one Best Documentary Feature, Kevin Klauber with 20 Feet from Stardom. And we have a friend of Frank's on next week, Kevin Miller, from direct the film Hellbound, and also another director coming on next week, John Putsch, son of... The Gene Stapleton, and Dale Gurdnick, who wrote a bunch of great sports books of my hometown team, the Pittsburgh Steelers. So just keep following the show. We have a lot of great guests coming up, and it's been a blessing to be with you. And please share this link. It's good in perpetuity to hear Frank's interview podcasted, this exact same link, because I think a lot of folks, be they from the religious right or just wanting more understanding of it, share this 30 minutes with them by just copying the link and sending it to your friends. God bless you guys. Until we're back on air.